Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hello and welcome to the latest Royal Automobile Club talk show, brought to you in association with Motorsport Magazine. We're at the Royal Automobile Club in Woodcote Park near Epsom today, and it's my great privilege to introduce to you reigning British Touring Car champion Colin Turkington. Colin, welcome. Nice to have you with us. And he'll be talking to me, Simon Aaron, features editor of Motorsport, and also one of the voices of the BTCC, Alan Hyde, a man who's actually been in the pit lane at every single one of Colin's touring car races. How many have you done?
Alan would probably know more than me. I think it's my, is it my 400th is coming up at Thruxton. There's a bit of a milestone coming up. So yeah, I suppose 14 or 15 years.
Yeah, and Alan's been at every one of those, so he's very well qualified to join us. So Alan, you're normally on the other side of the desk doing the sound engineering. Great to have you here. Thank you very much. Right, first off, Colin, what are you doing? There's a whole lot of, you're a BMW ambassador. You race the BMW for West Surrey Racing in the BTCC. There's a whole load of BMWs parked outside here. What are you actually doing today at the RAC apart from talking to us?
Primary reason really was obviously to come and see you guys and take part in the podcast. But yeah, one of my roles as a BMW ambassador, you know, I get to attend fantastic events like this, and we're here with Cooper BMW at the RAC club, and really to give members of the club an opportunity to see and drive these ultimate driving machines. You know, there's an amazing array of cars here today, most of which I have never yet driven. So things like the X5, the X7, the new 7 Series, 8 Series, the i8 Roadster. So an amazing selection of cars. So it's a wonderful opportunity, you know, to sample each one of those, and I suppose try before you buy.
So they haven't given you one of each as a company car yet?
I'm working on that. I think my favourite definitely after today was the X7. It's an incredible car. You know, I like the SUVs, and that is pure luxury along with performance. But I think I need to win a few more races before I'm going to get one of those.
So I mean, basically doubling up as a car salesman as well as a racing driver. Well, that's the impression. But let's go back to your day job. I mean, how did it all start for you? Was there some sort of strong family connection with the sport back in the day, or was it something you discovered for yourself as a kid?
Yeah, from I was a kid, motorsport was in and through our house. My dad, he rallied back in Northern Ireland and raced go-karts. As Alan will know, my mum did some co-driving for my dad. But even before that, my grandfather...
And they still got married despite that.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they never seemed to fall out. But before that, my grandfather had a real passion for motorbike racing, and particularly road racing in Ireland, which is still a massive sport. Yeah. And so I was brought up at local bike races. My dad sponsored local riders. He sponsored some local teams, and that was my motorsport education. You know, going to the Isle of Man TT, the Northwest 200, and you know, just seeing the speeds and the commitment of those riders. But I was always pushed away from two wheels. You know, being involved in the sport, we saw the dangers, we saw the accidents. You know, I remember only too well going to the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast to see Philip McCallan when he'd come off the bike, and it was the closest thing I'd seen to a dead man. You know, his body was in bits, and I knew straight away that wasn't for me. So
was that the moment that actually, I mean, had you sort of kind of quite fancied it until then?
I suppose I hadn't really considered it, but you know, as a kid, that probably scared me. And I thought, I don't want to be him. You know, I don't want to be in here. So I have two other brothers, and my older brother started racing go-karts, cadet go-karts at Nuts Corner in Northern Ireland. And I naturally followed him into the sport just as a hobby, just as a bit of fun, something to do at the weekends.
How long was it before you progressed through karts? I presume you did pretty well in karts. You did okay.
I was an average karter.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I was, for me, motorsport in those early years was just a bit of fun, and I didn't take it seriously at all. You know, I was I went out, did my racing, but I was more interested in just having a bit of play about with the other kids I was racing against. And I think karting back when I did it, you know, that's more than 20 years ago, wasn't as serious as I see it is now. And yeah, it was just something to do at the weekends with the family. And you know, I won many races, but I wasn't a top level karter by any stage.
He says average. Oh, and by the way, I won many races. Yeah, right. Okay.
But one interesting story, as you know, go karts can be quite fickle and unreliable.
Yes.
And as a kid, all you want to do is go out and put some laps in. You know, keep going round and round. And what frustrated me the most was with the go karts was on the Saturday. You know, practice qualifying day, the kart would be perfect. It would be singing. You would be up the sharp end. You put it in the truck, take it out the next day, and it wouldn't start. Wouldn't go. And you're like, what's going on here? So it got me that much that after 4 years of karts, I said, Dad, I can't take this anymore. I've had enough. You know, I'm not enjoying this. So off I went to play golf. And that lasted all of 6 weeks. No, slightly longer than that. You know, I wanted to do something completely different. And yeah, I picked up a set of golf clubs and I really enjoyed it. I loved it. You know, obviously it's the polar opposite, I think, of
it's cheaper.
Of motorsport. It's a bit cheaper, but you know, and we're blessed with some great courses and clubs in Ireland. So you know, I enjoyed playing golf, but there was always, I suppose, that burning desire and passion for motorsport.
Do you still play?
Not enough. No, I play a bit of crazy golf and pitch and putt, but no, I just don't like most people say, I don't have a spare 4 hours to commit to a full round of golf.
It is a big commitment, isn't it? It's a commitment of time. Yeah,
yeah, it is. And golf, I suppose, like motorsport, can be very frustrating. You need to put the hours in to maintain your level, or else you just start going backwards. So maybe when the motorsport career dies off a bit, I'll have more time for the golf course.
There's a decent golf course just out the window. Have you eyed that up? Or?
Yeah, there's two golf courses out the window. So yeah, I was eyeing that up in the X7 earlier just to see how it would go over that terrain. But being my first visit to the Royal Automobile Club, I thought I'll leave that for another day.
And so, what was the mechanism for getting yourself back into racing? I think you did a bit of autocross or something, didn't you? Or autocross?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I was lucky where I was brought up. In my dad was a builder. He was involved in construction, and we had a massive yard at home, a massive concrete yard. So I always had access to a vehicle, should that be a van, a forklift, or whatever. But as a kid, I loved cars, and I always had cars. So we had minis. I had Ford Cortinas, and I would just go down there and just drive around in the evenings for hours, you know, as fast as I could. So I was always, when I look back now, I was always developing my skills and my craft. And then I think when I was 14, there was an autograss club started up in Portadown. So that was, I remember so well going to the scrapyard and buying my Mini for £50 of my hard-earned pocket money, and brought it to a family friend, and we prepped the car ourselves, used a whole can of pop rivets and patched it back together. And I think that's when I fell in love with motorsport again. You know, it's a short oval racing on dirt, on grass, and it was a 1200 cc Mini, and it was just fun. You know, it was you're only using first and second gear. The muck's coming in through your mesh windscreen, and that was sort of reignited the passion.
And also, I mean, a lot of people are quite sniffy about short oval racing, whether it's stock cars or bangers or whatever, but loose surface stuff is fantastic for honing your car control, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great, you know, because even on the dry summer days, you know, we always had a bowser of water, you know, a tractor and tanker that would go out and wet the track, you know, as soon as it got remotely dry. So, yeah, you're constantly sharpening your skills. But for me, it was all just about, I needed to do something to enjoy motorsport again. And, you know, I have two boys now, and that's what I say to them. You know, it's we go out on our carts, but the most important thing is we have fun, because the moment it gets too serious or there's too much pressure, then you naturally step away from that. So I raced autograss for 2 years, loved every moment of it, and but even at that stage, you know, I come across this championship on TV. It was what's this, the BTCC, and wow, this looks like fun. You know, it was Saturday afternoon prime time viewing, and you know, that's when I started to get hooked on something else.
And you made your circuit debut in Ireland in a Metro.
Yeah, you've got it. Yeah.
I presume that was, again, just a family prep thing, and not putting something together in the backyard, was it? Or
yeah, that was you know, very, very low budget, and the only way I can explain the Metro, it was like racing a block of flats. So we did everything to try and make it fast. We took the window wipers off. I only had one mirror on the car, because obviously all these things are drag. We polished the car to within an inch of its life, but again, it was just cheap fun racing. And you know, we raced at Kirkeston, and you know, there's two long straights and a bit of a chicane either end, and you just slipstreaming, you know, these group of metros. And again, it's looking back now, it was, you know, that was my first experience of one make racing, and it was really, you know, developing my craft and my skills, but most importantly, you know, really making me enjoy motorsport.
When, I mean, you did the metros for a year or two, didn't you? Then you came over to the mainland to race Fiestas. Was that the kind of start in your mind of an attempt to actually sort of get yourself noticed by the wider world?
It wasn't at all, but by that stage it was purely because my brother had started at that stage racing in the UK. I went down the saloon car route, and he went down the single seater route. So my brother Gary come to the UK to race. Initially it was Formula Vauxhall Junior, and then onto Formula Ford. So Gary started coming over to England to race. So naturally, I followed, but you know, I wasn't pursuing a career at that stage. I was still watching the BTCC, but it wasn't on my radar that I could do that one day, or I want to do that. You know, I followed all sorts of motorsports. You know, I loved following Colin McRae in rallying. You know, Formula One was on our screens every Sunday. So my whole life was just immersed in motorsport. But again, the Fiestas was just the next step from, you know, from the Mini, the Metro, the Fiesta. You know, I was just keeping it all simple, and you know, that was a good place for me to go and learn all the tracks in the UK, and that was the big difference, because I only ever knew one circuit, Kirkeston, and you know, very quickly you become a specialist in one track. And I'll never forget arriving to Brands Hatch for the very first time, and just driving into the venue, and I was completely blown away by the place. You know, it was something that I had never seen before. You know, this amazing race circuit set down into a bowl, it was such a theatre, and it was just a whole new world had just immediately opened up to me. So yeah, the Fiestas was, you know, there's a lot of successful saloon car drivers come through the Fiesta series actually before me. I think Matt Neal did some Fiestas and
Gordon Shedden,
yeah. So again, it was a very, very good training ground, and you know, that was one of the championships that was on the support package to the BTCC. So again, it was one for me. It was one step closer to the British Touring Car Championship.
And also, it was the first time that you were sort of on the other side of the television screen that you'd been watching at home. You were sort of sucked into the BTCC, and then all of a sudden, you were part of the whole circus. That must have been a real eye opener that year.
It was very daunting for you know, for a kid from Northern Ireland who had never been exposed really to the wider world or to any sort of media. You know, I don't think I'd ever given an interview in my life. So you know, I would see I think it was Hay Fisher was running the program, so I would see them coming and just make a beeline for the back of the van.
Yeah,
so,
because so they naturally you're quite shy, aren't you?
Yeah, know, as I was 16 or 17 then, so I was shy, you know, and I'm, you know, I still am, I think, quite reserved, and I thought, I'm not going to know what to say, so I just try and hide and hope they go away and pick somebody else. So, you know, that was the start, I think, of my motorsport education.
And nobody had trained you how to do an interview, what to say, what not to say. None of the media training that so many drivers get when they're in karting nowadays.
These are the things that they don't teach you in schools. And I think, you know, and now all those opportunities and media training are available to the next generation coming through, and we all recognise the importance of that. But when I was doing it, you just, you know, when I look back at some of the interviews now, I just cringe. You know, it's so embarrassing, but, you know, that was, that's, you learn through your mistakes.
A question for you, actually, Al.
Yeah, go on.
When was the first time that you recall noticing Colin impressing on the touring car programme?
It really, I noticed Colin in his first year of the BTCC. It was a team that I was quite interested in, Colin, because it was Team Atomic Kitten.
I was going to ask him about that later.
We can cover that now. And it was a really cool thing. They were a huge band at the time, and all of a sudden there were people coming along and showing interest in the BTCC that maybe wouldn't have ever heard of the championship before. And there was a spotlight on you and your teammate, which was Gareth Howell, wasn't it, that year?
Yeah, massively. That, as Alan described, that was my first year into the British Touring Car Championship, and you know, even to get there, you know, for me, we didn't know anybody coming from Northern Ireland. You don't know any of the teams. You don't know with nobody really to open the door. And as I just said, my brother was racing in the Formula Ford with Van Diemen and Jonathan Lewis. And
can I just ask very quickly, if your plan had been to become part of the BTCC, was your brother's plan to go all the way in single seaters? Was that
sure
on his mind? Yeah,
oh, most definitely. Yeah. I think that was for sure on his radar. You know, he was looking at the career path to Formula One, and I think at that stage my dad was, you know, he was going to try to do everything he could to help him on that journey. But I think very quickly you understand your level within the sport, and you understand that there is 20 guys on that F1 grid, and you know, he'd been Formula Vauxhall Junior, Formula Ford, Formula Renault, and each step up is an even greater financial commitment than the one before. So I think you get your eyes opened very quickly, and you think, okay, you know, maybe this is not the best way to invest money.
So
but it was through Gary actually that or through my brother's team that I got an introduction to Dick Bennett, you know, the team principal of West Surrey Racing. And when I look back now, I'm so fortunate that he was the first guy that I met, the first guy that we spoke to. You know, I really landed on my feet, and since that day, West Surrey Racing has been the home for me.
Your and, family.
And it's been much more than a race team. It's been my family and the perfect environment to, you know, for me to perform at my best.
I'm going to ask a question of Simon now because Simon has been involved in motor racing for many, many years, longer than I've been involved in it, Colin. I know that's hard to believe, but when did you first come into contact with Dick Bennett, the boss of WSR, West Surrey Racing?
That would have been 1982. When he was Kiki Mansell in Formula 3.
So through the Senna.
Yeah.
Through the Senna era.
Back then I'd be covering Formula 3 races 7 or 8 times a year for Motoring News, it would have been then, yeah. So I first met him in 82 at Cadwell Park, actually.
He's an incredible character, isn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. We did a feature in Motorsport with him recently, a lunch, a sort of 4,000 or 5,000 word piece. And lunch could have gone on for... I think it went on for 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
It could have gone on for 13 and a half.
I've had flights sitting next to Dick that could have lasted just a lot longer.
He's an amazing guy. He is, such a background. And he's run so many fantastic drivers over time. But he's really, as you say, West Surrey Racing's become your kind of spiritual home in touring cars, but you haven't always, you've nipped away for a season with Vauxhall, a couple of years with BMR, and there was a time you weren't racing in the BTCC because of sponsorship concerns, but you always end up back there, don't you?
Yeah, I think you gravitate towards your family, and that's the team that I felt most comfortable in, and that's where I delivered my best results. And, you know, Dick Bennett says, I think they have 13 Formula One drivers through their team, so... I remember going to West Surrey Racing for the first time with my mum and dad, and just, you know, getting a look around the premises, and in this boardroom, he has this amazing collection of helmets. There's an unwritten rule with Dick: if you ever win a race, you have to give him that helmet. So he's got helmets from Ayrton Senna, Jonathan Palmer, Rubens Barrichello, Eddie Irvine. There's one of mine up there. So I'm keeping very good company. But I think the thing that sets Dick Bennett apart is the attention to detail. You know, he is as methodical and enthused about motorsport now as he probably was back in 1982 whenever he met you. You know, he's so passionate about the team, about winning, about delivering for BMW. And he's just a one-off. And, you know, we always talk about the debriefs we have on a Saturday night.
Whether
qualifying has went good or bad, you know you're in there for at least an hour. But some of the stories that I have heard over the years, you know, about the Formula 3 days, the days with Ayrton Senna, the days with Mikki Hakkinen, some of the insights that I have got have been fantastic. And if you walked into Dick Bennett's office today, he will still have the report files, you know, setup sheets from Ayrton Senna, from Mika Hakkinen. They are in his filing cabinet.
I know, because when we were doing a piece recently with one of Dick's old Rolt RT3s, and I phoned him up and said, we've got this car. It was the one that Mansell had raced in 82 that Ayrton had made his F3 debut in at the end of that year at Thruxton. And I phoned him up and said, just out of curiosity, I don't suppose you still have the setup sheet, because I know you've got... Yeah, I said I said to him, I said, you famously hoard everything ever. I said, you wouldn't happen to have the setup sheet from that Thruxton meeting? And he said, hang on a second. And he was back on the phone within 30 seconds saying, yeah, it was 15 degrees, and he got the lap times, and he knew exactly where it was.
Just in fact, I'm surprised he couldn't tell you the setup without even needing to get the sheet. He's the sort of guy he could just... You know, spit that straight out.
But I mean, he had the Hewland gearbox serial number and the engine serial number and, you know, the tyre. It's fantastic.
Incredible.
But just reverting slightly, how the flipping heck did you end up with Atomic Kitten as a sponsor? I mean, you're saying you don't know anybody, and you turn up in British Touring Car Championship with one of the most famous contemporary pop groups on the side of your car.
Shy young man from Northern Ireland, and all of a sudden...
You don't say boo to a goose, and you end up with Atomic Kitten on your car.
Pure fluke and good timing. Yeah, very, very fortunate. Dick was running the Works AMG team. That was 2002. So they wanted to... AMG wanted to set up a junior team, a satellite team, for two young aspiring drivers. So Myself and Gareth Howell happened to be the chosen ones. I had won the Ford Fiesta Championship the year before, and Gareth was a front runner in that too. So I'm not quite sure how the Atomic Kitten connection come to MG, but for me it was a double-edged sword. It was good in that it put such a focus on these two new young guys coming into the BTCC, and you know, the girls actually come to two of the races. They come to our very first race at my very first race at Alton Park.
Did you hide in the back of the van then?
No. I was propped on the bonnet. Suddenly my shyness left. But yeah, it was again, it was an eye opener, but it really put the spotlight on us, and part of me did feel a bit uneasy with that. But the good thing is, you know, as soon as you're in the car, as soon as you put the helmet on, all those things go to one side, and you just want to get to the front.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You've been in the BTCC with a couple of years sabbatical for sponsorship reasons ever since then. Have you ever been tempted at any point to consider something else? GTs or anything like that?
My passion has always been touring cars, and I've dabbled in little the odd race here and there outside of touring cars. But you know, I love the competitive environment. I love the door to door. You know, I love everything about the BTCC, how competitive it is, and you know, that's where I've been able to be successful, and that's where I've been able to make a career. And yes, I think you almost can get pigeonholed as just a touring car driver. You know, that there's Colin Turkington, he's another one of those crazy touring car drivers, but you know, that's what I've always loved doing. And you know, I've been fortunate to be in the championship now for I think it's 14 or 15 seasons, and you know, there's been some good times, but there's been some really tough times as well, especially after winning championships, where suddenly it becomes very difficult to get back on the grid the following season. So, you know, touring cars is obviously requires quite a big financial commitment, and you know, that's one of the biggest challenges we face year on year.
That was a disappointment, like Nigel Mansell and Damon Hill not returning to the team after winning the Formula One World Championship. It was a big disappointment when you couldn't make it back to the BTCC.
This was 20. He won the first title in 2009.
Yes,
and then the sponsor pulled out at the end of the season, and you were off the grid.
Yeah, correct. You know, I was very fortunate in that the RAC had backed our team from 2006, and I think they signed 2005, and then they signed a 3-year program, so 5, 6, 7, and you know, that's as far as we ever thought we could get with the RAC, and that was a good term for a title sponsor. But they kept renewing, you know, if we'll do one more year, we'll do one more year. And it, you know, culminated in 2009 with me winning the championship. And you know, when I look back now, it's as a driver, you know, I was probably a little bit naive, because you just expect the team to get the sponsor. You know, the team will get the sponsor and I'll do the drive and I'll deliver the goods. And especially when you're in a season, when you're leading the championship, the blinkers are on. All you can think about is performance, my own performance and winning races. And you're not thinking about next year. You're not thinking about, am I going to be in the grid next year? You know, do I need to bring sponsors? Has the team got sponsors in place? You're purely just looking at Brands Hatch Grand Prix and how you can win that championship. And, you know, I don't blame myself because that was the first opportunity I had to win the BTCC. So I was throwing everything at it. I did not want to think beyond the last race of the season. I just wanted to win that championship. And if I never did another race again in my life, I would be happy. Because that was my dream from when I started. You know, racing was to get into BTCC and then to win it. But yeah, I really had the rug pulled from under me whenever I didn't make the grid.
You say that it, you know, if you'd never done another race, you'd have been happier. But I bet you weren't at the start of 2010, were you? For 3 seasons, I think you did a little bit of World Touring Car Championship, you did a bit of Scandinavian Touring Car Championship, but how did it feel looking? I mean, you obviously thought your rightful place should have been back at Brands, back at Thruxton, back at Alton.
Yeah,
against your familiar rivals.
It was a really difficult period of my life because, you know, obviously when you win the championship, then automatically your goals shift. So I've got one in the bag. So you start thinking about next year. And then quickly I realised that, you know, this is proving difficult to be back on the grid. And, you know, I'd be in dialogue with the team every week. But, you know, when the REC left, there was such a big hole to fill, you know. And there wasn't many title sponsors of that scale around. So, you know, when it got back around to the start of the season and when I wasn't on that grid, it was the worst possible thing to be sitting at home on Sunday afternoon watching everybody else out there having fun.
Back to where you started.
Exactly. Yeah. It was.
So you didn't actually attend the first race.
I couldn't go.
No.
I didn't go to any races that year. You know, if I wasn't competing, it was breaking my heart not to be on the grid. And actually to see somebody else in my car with West Surrey Racing, you know, the team was able to continue. You know, they got some small sponsors back on board and they got another two drivers. So the heart was ripped out of me. And it's not until you're on the sidelines that you really realize how much you miss it and how much you want to be part of it. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is that the longer you're out of the championship or a championship, the harder it is to get back in, because somebody fills your seat. And you know, whenever somebody else gets into a good team like West Surrey Racing, they don't want to leave it. So, you know, for me, you know, obviously I was looking about to see how I could get back racing, but it was...
And Dick would have had you in the car in a heartbeat, wouldn't he, if he could have done the deal to have you in the car?
Yeah, you know, we wanted to defend the championship together. You know, after so many years of working as a team together to reach that ultimate goal, you know, Dick had won Formula 3 championships, but he'd never won a British Touring Car race. You know, he'd been in the championship from 1996, I believe, with the Ford Mondeo. So that was, you know, 11 years before he had won the championship. So it was a big disappointment on everybody's behalf. But we were able then in 2010 to put a part season together with West Surrey Racing and eBay Motors. So I did 6 races from mid-season on of the World Touring Car Championship, and that was good. You know, it was something different. It was refreshing. It was in the car that I knew. It was in the E93 series. So yeah, it was fun going to race with the best of the World Championship.
I suppose on the positive side, you didn't have him sticking a microphone under your nose every fortnight. So, yeah, there was an upside to it.
every cloud. What in your experience, people that you've spoken to in championships around the world. What is the secret of the success in the BTCC? You've kind of described that it's your home, the one that you want to come back to, a bit like WSR, you know, you're happy in the team. But what's the secret of success? Because it's a unique championship, isn't it?
It's a very tricky championship to win. You know, obviously it's important to be in a front running team with a car that gives you the capability to win races and reliability. You need all these things. But I think the most important factor is resilience. You know, with BTCC, there's so many things will not go your way, and there are more tough days than there are good days, but you just have to keep working hard and grafting for every single point. No matter how insignificant that one point may be, you have to go out there and work for it. And I think it's because it's the level playing field we have in the BTCC. You know, this year there's 30 cars. We've had 32 cars on the grid, and we're all doing the same speed. We all have the same capabilities to win races. So the margins are so, so fine that, in my opinion, or I think what I have taught myself to believe, is that the guy who works harder is the guy that will come out on top, because we're all good drivers. You know, we're all in fast cars. You know, there's a balance of performance. So, you know, there was two events last year where the full 30 grid of cars qualified within 1 second. So then you got to think, how am I going to come out on top? You know, what can I do to make myself better than these 29 other guys? And when you understand that you've got people like Matt Neal, triple champion, Gordon Shedden, triple champion, Jason Plato, double champion, you know, these guys have been doing this for a lifetime. You've got a new young wave of drivers coming through with no fear. They're not worried about respecting the older drivers. So, you know, for me, it was important to maybe look at some other sports and see, you know, how in other sports, how do you find a competitive advantage? What do you do? And then that's, for me, when it gets exciting. You know, it's more now than just about driving the car. So you start to understand your mental approach to the sport, your psychology. You know, you start talking to yourself. You know, you got to believe in your own ability, and you know, there's always that negative voice in your head that will tell you, I'm not as good as you, I'm not as fast as you, you know, I'm not going to beat you today. But it's learning how to manage those thoughts, how to override those thoughts. Things, you know, how can I sleep better, how can I eat better, how can I have more energy? So, you know, that's when it becomes fun for me, is whenever you start chasing the last little bit. You know, how do you find the margin? And that's, I think, what keeps me going. That's what keeps me coming back to BTCC, because you're always trying to find the best version of yourself, and you're never done at that. You know, I'm so fortunate to have won the BTCC three times, but I always know that there's a better version of me out there, and every year you feel that you're getting a little bit closer, a little bit closer. So that's where the fun is. It's the chase to find the best version of yourself.
With the psychological stuff, have you had any outside assistance with that, or is it something you just simply prepare yourself?
Most of it I've just learned myself. I did some sports studies, some sports psychology at university, but that was you know, that was maybe one semester. It was a quick overview of sports psychology, so nothing really, that no tools in there that I could use. But for me, it was just about you know, actually reading the papers a lot. You know, reading the back pages of the papers and hearing how, you know, a lot of coaches what they say to their players. You know, particularly in, you know, I follow football quite a lot, and you know, obviously the Premier League has become massively competitive, and you know, you start to, you know, I really started to look behind the scenes, and you know, once I become aware that, you know, all these teams employ sports coaches, they do a lot of mental preparation, and once your mind's open to this, there's such a wealth of information, on the net. But I would go onto Amazon and just buy books and read them cover to cover, and then really pull pieces from those books that I could then harness, and tools and techniques that I could use to, bring myself to what they call the zone and keep myself in the zone. That's the most important place. So I've really enjoyed the challenge of that, and you're never the finished article, and even now, you still doubt yourself, you still doubt whether you can win another championship, but I have to override that.
Well, this is your 15th season in touring cars now. You've won 3 titles. So when are we going to see the finished Colin Turkington, and how good's he going to be?
He may already be finished. I may have peaked. I'm not sure, but...
You've got a record to equal before that.
Yes. I think there's 7 or 8 drivers have won the championship 3 times, and Andy Rouse is, the legend that is Andy Rouse is the one guy that has won the championship 4 times. So that's what I'm targeting next. I don't know if I'll do it, if it's for sure it's possible, and especially now with the being with Team BMW, I have one of the best cars. I have the tools at my disposal to do the job, but like I said, to win a championship, you need a special mix of ingredients. You need the good car, the good team. You need to be given it 100%, but I think the stars also need to align. You need the little bits of luck, and the cards need to fall your way on those particular days. So, all I can do is keep delivering my best performance, like I said before, hard work, and keep chasing the dream. If I could match that record, then I would want the 5th. So I'm fortunate that I still have this competitive instinct in me, and when I'm out in the car, I'm representing myself and my family, but also BMW and all the sponsors and partners and team members. It's the guys on the ground, it's my mechanics, that the car is their baby. They're working at that car 6 days a week, and they're grafting their lives out. So it's such a nice feeling to be able to reward them with race wins, with championship wins. So that's the driving force.
I've absolutely loved this. We could easily talk for another hour or so, but we are going to have to wind things down fairly soon. So just one thing, if I can ask you about, you mentioned earlier that you get 30-odd cars covered by a second, and that's the norm. Usually the top 20, 25 are within a second. So it's inevitable, certainly around some of Britain's more compact circuits, Brands Hatch, Indy, for example, contact's going to happen. It's not because you guys are being hooligans, it's because the nature of the beast, you are all so closely matched. Some people are fairly sniffy about driving standards in the BTCC. I mentioned that to Alan Gow a few weeks ago, and I think he's still several feet off the ground. He's looking back on it. People are sniffy about it, but I think certainly in the last 5-10 years, you look at the last race of last year, for example, Ash Sutton and Josh Cook, who were this far apart for side-by-side around Brands Hatch for 18 laps or whatever it was. The standard is there are shunts because it's...
Colin wasn't watching that because he'd just won the championship in the previous race.
That's true. But, I think the standard in recent seasons is incredibly high. It's certainly at the front.
I would agree with you 100%. It's the quality of driving is up there with any championship in the world, and I think people underestimate the BTCC. They underestimate how competitive it is and how difficult it is. You see some very good drivers coming in and struggling, and the driving standards, yes, you get certain events where there's maybe more crashes and accidents than normal, but when you consider Brands Hatch is 1.2 miles long, we're going around there in 49 seconds. Knock Hill is 1.3 miles long, so to get 30 cars just alone on the track, it fills half the track. So there's going to be especially the first few laps, you know, when we're all piling into Paddock Hill Bend and Druids, you know, everybody's trying to get to the front, and there will be that concertina effect, so there will be contact, but you know, it's part of the game, it's part of the sport, and you know, I think, you know, that's what the punters love, you know, that's the appeal of BTCC, that's what we don't see with Formula One. You know, you don't see this door-to-door action, you know, you don't see people nibbling at each other's bumpers, and I think genuinely the drivers respect each other, you know they really do, and maybe there was a case a few years ago where driving standards that did dip, you know, that there become a lot of this push to pass, you know, where it wasn't, you know, drivers weren't passing each other through skill or tact, you know, they maybe just run into the rear bumper of the car and push them past the apex, and you know, that's not a professional way to go about motorsport, but you know,
it's a different interpretation of push to pass.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. But you know, very quickly Alan Guy clamped down on that and, you know, introduced you know, a driving standards advisor to him, and we have this strike system now, so if you are a bad boy, you know, you've only got a few chances, you know, once you get three strikes, you start the next race at the back of the grid, so there's a big penalty now if you do misbehave, so, you know, I think the balance is very good, and, you know, there's not one person that comes to a touring car race or watches a touring car race that doesn't enjoy it.
Okay. Incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, we've received a few questions from motorsport readers and elsewhere on social media. So, Alan, we're going to sign off just now with. We always appreciate the questions, Alan. If you could,
So
pick out a selection.
So, Wes Hooker says, which drivers are your fiercest competitors on the BTCC grid?
Obviously, the biggest battle internally is with your teammates, because they can see everything. You know, that's who you're judged against. You know, we've got three identical cars and, you know, an open book policy in terms of data, so my teammates can see everything I do in the car. But I would say, you know, I've been partnered with some fantastic drivers through the years. You know, one of the very first one was Anthony Reid, and he really was my mentor. He took me under his wing and taught me the good and the bad of BTCC.
He's a great character.
He's a fantastic guy. And you know, then I was partnered with Ivan Muller at Vauxhall. But I think the guy that I had to work hardest with and against was my 2 years with Jason. Jason Plato, and you know, those were two really tough years, because we're both at the top of our game, and we both wanted to be top dog. And you know, the first year in the front wheel drive Volkswagen Passat, he came out on top, and the second year in the rear wheel drive Subaru, I came out on top. But you know, we were pushing each other so hard, it had almost become maybe a negative influence on the team, because both my side of the garage wanted to beat his side of the garage so much, and you know, we're pushing each other to the absolute maximum. But you know, for drivers it was great, because we got everything out of that car. And you know, the Subaru, it was an amazing project. You know, we started the season with a brand new car, and I went to the final with an opportunity to win the championship, having had to withdraw from Thruxton. So it was an incredible year.
So one more, I'll pick one more. Just a nod to Andy Owen, who says, has Colin ever considered a switch to GT3 or GT4 competition with Blanc Panel British GT? I think we pretty much covered that one earlier on. But Robin Llewellyn Leach says, when will your boys, also known as Mini Turks, be following in your footsteps and donning their helmets and gloves to take up motorsport? They're already karting, aren't they?
Yeah, we're already at the kart track, and it's only going one way. You know, it's you know, obviously it's at school, and I've tried to let them experience all sports, you know, and with school they've done that, but it just runs in the family. You know, when I put them in the go-kart, you just see the smile on their face. And Lewis, my oldest boy, is you know, he's even more into it than I was as a kid. You know, when we're actually going to the kart track, he has the fireproofs, the suit and the helmet on in the car on the way to the track. He just cannot wait. And the adrenaline is going through him, you know, as we go up the motorway. So it's, you know, it's a great way to bond, you know, as father and son.
You
and,
said something a couple of years ago at the end of the season, which was just lovely. And I think you said it at the end of season awards dinner. So I remember there was in the audience there was a palpable female because you said we're making memories for the family with going racing. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. You know, I don't remember much of my father competing, rallying, and racing go karts, but my boys are at a fantastic age. You know, 8 and 9 years old, where they've been to pretty much every race that I've done, you know, through social media and all these things. We have an amazing catalogue of images, of videos. You know, Lewis, my oldest, was 3 months when I won that first championship in 2009. So he was there. And, you know, each year we look back and reflect on just some amazing memories. And if I wasn't competing in motorsport, you know, I don't think we would spend so much quality time together at racetracks. And for them, it's such an education, because they at their age are learning about motorsport, the bigger picture, you know, because obviously, you know, other kids they just go out and race, they go out and see, you know, they just go out and drive a kart. But my boys are very fortunate in that they see what I do behind the scenes. They see how I prepare for races, all the homework that I do. They come to the simulators with me. They bash me off the track most of the times. But you know, they see the business side to BTCC. You know, they have to communicate with adults. They have to you know, stand at attention when we go into BMW Hospitality. And. And you know that they're meeting the hierarchy of BMW. So it's been a fantastic education, and you know, hopefully it continues. And we were at Donington Historic. I raced at Donington Historic last weekend in an E30 BMW, and it was the first time that the boys had noticed that we'd been to, you know, an endurance event where there was two names on the windows of each car. And The switch flicked in Lewis, my older boy's head, and he said, "Dad, you know, it's only going to be probably another 7-8 years before we'll have Turkington and Turkington
wow.
on the side of the car. So already the wow. seed is planted that we'll be driving together." And, you know, I really hope that happens. You know, Andy Jordan, my teammate, he was able to race alongside his father, Mike.
For 1 year.
You know, I think those potentially the only guys that have done it in BTCC. So I'm not sure another 10 years where my level is going to be, but certainly I think Lewis's sights are set on BTCC.
That's lovely.
Yeah, that's an absolutely fantastic note on which to finish. And I said we could continue this for twice as long again, but we'll have to get you back. Colin, thanks ever so much for your time. Al, thanks for your contribution.
Thanks, Simon.
And thank you to all of you for watching, for listening, for sending in the questions. We look forward to welcoming you back very, very soon to the next Royal Automobile Club talk show in association with Motorsport. Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.